you're saying.
It wasn't exactly a state dinner anyway, but that's fine. No, it was just another ceremonial stop without a, didn't seem to us a heck of a lot of substance. There couldn't have been. They were only there 24 hours, that long. The kind of substance that took place would be pretty limited. That's right, Bill Sullivan was there for that. Yeah, he had to be. But he got there just before. Couldn't have been there very long before that.
Mm-hmm. Now, in his campaign, of course, Carter emphasized the importance of human rights issues.
Yeah.
Did your contacts in the Iran government, or people you talked with who were with the embassy, did they suggest that this concern had a real impact on the way diplomacy was conducted?
Yes, yes, it was very much in everybody's portfolio. Mrs. Darien or Miss Darien's strictures on democratization and all the rest of her baggage were always brought to mind, and the general human rights issue was one that was constantly hammered by the Carter administration in Iran, into Iran. And it was probably that as much as anything else that sort of forced the Shah, or moved the Shah into making a lot of steps, taking a lot of steps in 1978, early 78, that eventually probably led to his downfall. Easing opposition activities, permitting street demonstrations. Maybe he had no choice, I don't know. But the spectacle of the Shah and the Shahbanu in the White, on the White House lawn, wiping away tears caused by tear gas, was really pretty shocking. And that happened, what, 4 months later, I guess, was April?
Well, no, in November.
Was it
before Carter's visit to the country?
Was that 77 or 78?
Yeah, 77. Like November, October, November.
Okay, anyways, that was and caused by Iranian students abroad, vast numbers of them. I thought it was later than that. I thought it was after. It was after the New Year's visit.
It was before.
I guess it was before. Yeah. Memories tend to get fuzzy.
Some of the accounts I read recently suggest that, in practice, as the administration proceeded, Carter advanced, among others, tended to subordinate the human rights issue to the strategic issues of arms sales, the role of the Shah in the Persian Gulf.
But and that was after Afghanistan.
Well, even before. I mean, did you get a sense of that? Did you get a sense of that, apparently, from your vantage point?
No, not from our vantage point. I didn't get a sense of that. Brzezinski, of course, was a apparat cheek of realpolitik to some degree. But it was only after Afghanistan, which was 77, I think, wasn't it?
Nine.
No.
The invasion?
Okay. The invasion, but 79.
The coup.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. That was a year or two earlier.
Yeah. 77, I think. I'm almost certain.
Yeah, that's right.
That the American attitude towards Afghanistan and the area began to, the Carter attitude towards Afghanistan and the area began to shift. Because clearly the regime that came into power in Afghanistan was a pro-Soviet regime, no matter how bad it was, how badly organized it was. And so that caused a rethinking, I think, of a lot of the problems in the area. And the problem of Bhutto was another one that sort of impinged on all of this. That's about the time he was Khan, wasn't it? 76, 77,
sure,
something like that.
Now, shortly after Carter's visit, the Iranian government ran a newspaper article that criticized Ayatollah Khomeini, which led to demonstrations in Qom that were violently repressed.
Well,
that's sort of the sequence, as I recall.
Article was allegedly written by Dariush Homayoun.
Yeah.
He denies it. He's a very nice man, by the way.
Actually, in James Bill's book, he suggested a lower level person actually wrote the article.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But his name was associated with it.
Uh-huh.
And it needn't have happened, needn't have been written, but yes, that was one of the proximate causes of demonstrations and more distaste for the Shah's regime. Mm-hmm. Just solidified opposition. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, hell, by that time they had, as I've pointed out many times, they had managed to offend almost every aspect of government, mm-hmm. civilian, mm-hmm. intellectual, religious, business, trade, in the country. The only thing they thought they had going for them was the military, and that turned out to be a weak reed.
Mm-hmm. Now, this event, the repression of the demonstrations at Qom touched off a cycle of demonstrations and protests that encompassed the whole country.
The exact progression is a little fuzzy in my mind. I thought the first demonstration that caused the repression of Qom took place in Tabriz, because there were people killed up there, and 40 days later they started holding the mourning period, and that then took place in Qom, and then there was Tabriz, and then there was this, and there was that, there was the Abadan fire, and it just sort of snowballed.
Did you witness or know about the protests that were taking place in Tehran in the first month of 78, as part of the
yes,
cycle?
Yes, we knew about them, but it wasn't really until later on that we could see them and feel the effects, for instance, of the strikes in the passport section, and the foreign residence section of the Interior Ministry, when you couldn't get exit permits and so forth and so on.
What was your initial evaluation of the protests that were breaking out in early 78? Did you see them as very striking?
We were concerned about them, but we never really felt, I never really felt, and most of my colleagues never really felt, with one or two exceptions, that the Shah was in any danger. All he had to do was twist, tighten the faucet a little bit, tighten the screws a little bit, and everybody would go back in their holes, was the attitude. And that this was permitting a little bit of pressure to escape, and that when enough pressure had escaped, they would put the lid back on, and we'd go on our merry way, and maybe this would have had a salutary effect over the long run for the people of Iran, but that it was simply one more step in the progression of Iranian political development that had to take place in an orderly, slow, stately, step-by-step manner. Going overnight from dictatorial Shahdom to democracy was clearly not in anybody's imagination.
Now, you said that there are a few exceptions, people that were more, took a more somber interpretation of what was going on. Mm-hmm. Do you recall who they were?
James Saghi, an American of Lebanese extraction, who was the Kimberly Clark man, and Nobs of Her paper, and Nobs of Her sports, and a very active. He pulled out in 77. He saw the writing on the wall, he now says, and he sold his house at the top of the market in the Elahie for something approaching $2.5 million cash, which he took out of the country immediately, and moved lock, stock, and barrel to San Francisco, where he lives happily ever after, with a 400-acre spread in Napa, luxury apartments in San Francisco, and numerous other investments, of course. Still very wealthy. Lloyd Berkman was another one. Lived in Iran for 28 years. Ran something called Jupiter Trading Company. His proximate complaint was the Anti-Corruption Act. He says, if I have to live and report under that, I can't, because there's no way to do business in this country unless you play by the Iranian rules. You can't impose American rules here. And besides that, he said, there are things that are happening that make me uncomfortable, so I'm going to leave. So he sold out again towards the end of 77, I think it was.
So this is all before 78 then?
All before 78.
Demonstration,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, before the demonstrations. Another one who voiced his suspicion that everything was going to fall apart was Bill Shoshua, who was an Iraqi, an American citizen of Iraqi Jewish ancestry, who was the Peugeot, among other things. The Peugeot represented the Iranian army. We talked often about how the place was going to hell in a handbasket, and he kept thinking that he ought to withdraw and move out, but he waited until the last minute. He had enough money abroad anyway. But others who, they were really the only ones that I know who acted on their feelings, their suspicions that something dire was going on. Oh, and there was one Iranian who did the same thing. He moved out in, well, I guess he didn't move out until 78, but he moved out in the summer of 78, when it was still possible to go, with all of his chattel, all of his extensive collection of priceless Iranian artifacts and things, and carpets and so on. He lives in London and New York and does very nicely, thank you.
Did your contact the embassy? Did you discuss these issues with them, the 78 demonstrations with them?
Yes. Well, you know, we had, the Chamber of Commerce had a periodic meeting with the embassy, uh-huh. with the ambassador. Now, they tended to become a little bit stilted because we now had a couple of Iranians on the board. Rahim Irvani, from the head of Meli Group, Ahmad Lajavardi, Haji Barkhadar, no, he did not become a member. But those two especially would come to the meetings with the ambassador, and naturally there was some restrictions on how open they could be. Nonetheless, most of us felt the embassy was never very forthcoming with us when it came to difficulties. That to some degree, in the latter part of the summer of 78 and the beginning of the fall, the American business community was being urged to stay put, not to show, not to desert, not to show any lessening.
By the embassy.
Yeah. Yeah. Not to show any lessening of support for the Shah, and so on. We were, in a sense, being held hostage by the embassy. for this policy of supporting the Shah.
Did any of your contacts in the government of Iran or the business community, were they trying to find ways to smooth things over between the government and the opposition? Or people take any initiatives to...
I never came across anybody who was trying to do that.
Yeah.
The few people who had bridges built to both sides, at least to some degree, in the intellectual side, were not sufficiently tied in or were overly identified with the regime to be useful in this. And it was, I never got the feeling that there was any real attempt at dialogue between the differing parts. And you know, when the religious element began to make itself felt, it was clear that they weren't interested in dialogue. Although I have often and publicly said that I did not consider the Iranian revolution in its fullest to be a religious revolution. It was a middle-class revolution. It was a revolution in which all sides agreed on only one thing, that was to get rid of the Shah, but there was no agreement on what the form of the government then, would take after the revolution. And that's where it all, you know, became terribly, terribly difficult.
Now, in August 78, the Shah tried to find ways to placate the opposition by he promised Western-style democracy. He promised to change the calendar to please the religious opposition. He promised, I think, tax cuts, wage hikes to please business, labor. And he appointed a Sharif Imami.
Sharif Imami.
Imami as a prime minister.
Yeah, which was, and who took all the lids off the press. We had a completely free press for about a month in Iran for the first time in my memory. But by that time, there was nothing the Shah could do. This is hindsight speaking now. Sharif Imami was a discredited politician to begin with. They were all, most people were, he did not have the respect of even the people he purported to represent, that is, the upper crust. And even there were some who said, well, this is the Masonic lodge at work. The Masons were widely reputed to be the managers of the whole country anyway. Have you ever heard that?
Yeah, I've heard that theory.
Well, Sharif Imami was one of the senior Masons in the country, apparently. So was the Speaker of the House. That was his name again, Bernard.
Speaker of the Lodges?
Yeah.
But going back to that time, do you think that those concessions were going to be having any meaningful impact at that point in time?
Those concessions?
Yeah. Or?
No, we did not. But by that time, you know, strikes were all over the place. Banks were strike. You couldn't get money sometimes. You couldn't get exit visas. You couldn't. There were a lot of things you couldn't do. And it was very difficult. In August, September, October, just to go about your daily life. By November, early November, which is when Tehran was pretty much, well, I say they burned Tehran, which is, and that's when the riots really got out of hand. No amount of concessions by the Shah would have satisfied the opposition, by then. They had the bit in their teeth then. And that by that time they knew that they had pretty well eaten into the integrity of the military. By that time, too, no one knows for sure when he turned, but General Fardoust, who was the Shah's closest advisor, had turned traitor, apparently. Maybe one or another of the other generals as well. So, you know, by that time, again, this is all hindsight. The Shah knew how ill he was, but nobody else knew, except the French doctors.
Had there been rumors about that?
Well, there were rumors all the time about the Shah having kidney problems, impotence, a few other serious things, heart problems.
Nothing like a fatal...
No. But, you know, this is true of any dictator. I remember when I was first in Spain in 1955, Franco was about on death's door every week. When I went back in 1975, he was still there.
So, a little closer.
Yeah, but closer, and he did die later that year.
And of course, all before, you know, in early September, there were the famous Black Friday events at Jolly Square.
Yes, Jolly Square.
Those
were known.
Yeah.
No, well, and the fire in Abadan, which was a month before, was a terrible catastrophe, and that's what led to Amusigar's downfall. He didn't show any sensitivity, whatever. He didn't go down there to investigate himself. He may have sent a representative, but it was, you know, widely rumored that the theater was locked by Sabah,
yeah, yeah,
and set fire to on purpose, to blame it on the opposition. And then there was when did the earthquake in Tabah take place?
I'm not sure about the chronology on that one.
And somewhere in the same, not too long after that, and that's when the Empress decided that she didn't really love her people all that much after all.
You mentioned that last time.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I did. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, with the Black Friday events, and the killing of protesters in the square, around that time, September, did you think that there was any possibility for the government to make an accommodation with the opposition? Do you think?
Again, you yeah. know, quoting, and I may have quoted him before, quoted on Parman Parmayan, who yeah. said, you know, all, and there's about 'We all expected the old man to pull something out of his sleeve. Only this time he couldn't. He didn't have anything up his sleeve to pull out. And there was many people, including myself, had sort of blind faith that the Shah would survive. And U.S. government support with the Shah for the Shah was well placed and should continue. The evidence to the contrary was widely discounted. Not
this is true of the embassy as well, I take it.
You know, it's hard for me to say. It's
yeah.
hard for me to say about
yeah.
that. I wasn't that close to the embassy in those days.
But you have a few contacts that talk about these things, or whatever, yeah, sure. whatever regarded yeah.
their they were very guarded in their analyses. But, you know, Brzezinski was still very staunch in his support of the Shah. And the trouble is the State Department was less staunch in its support, by the sounds of things, at least ex post facto.
And at any point during the late summer or fall of 78, did you travel outside of Tehran?
Let me stop and think. Did we travel outside of Tehran in 78? We did at Nowruz. We took our traditional trip to...
That's in December?
Nowruz, no, that's in March.
Oh, March, that's right, March. Right.
We did in March in 78. Yeah. I went to Kashan, as I recall, yeah. and Chogazambil, farther down, Haptape, Despol, and so on. And we went to the Caspian, but I did not go to Tabriz or Mashhad or any place else in 78. I was spending more of my time for General Electric, briefing them on what was happening. And so in October, for instance, I went to Copenhagen to brief the chairman of the company and the international board on the events in Iran. And I was, by that time, I had written a speech with slides and all the rest, which I still have, as a matter of fact, headlines of daily newspapers and so on. That was very discouraging. Well, my boss in London said, "Don't be so discouraging." So I softened a little bit, but not...
What was the thrust of your...
My thrust was yeah. that... this is a tough time, and that it's questionable whether the guy is going to survive. But by the time my boss had worked me over a little bit, I pushed it a little bit to the other side, and yeah, he would survive.
So by October, you were not so sure then?
I was not so sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess it is the same month. Important U.S. establishment figures like John J. McCoy were pressing the State Department push the Shah to begin a military crackdown
yeah.
on the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any foreign businessmen in Iran who were putting pressure on the embassy to take a similar approach, pressing the Shah to start a crackdown? Or?
No, I wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
the business community in Iran were not in that position vis-a-vis the embassy to urge the Shah to crack down.
Yeah.
That was not, just not our, a role had never been created for us. They wouldn't have listened to us in the first place, probably.
Did word about, did people like McCoy's pressure come back to turn around? Was that?
No.
That wasn't on?
No, that was.
Okay.
But when Dick Cooper, for instance, came out to look things over.
The Treasury, yeah.
Well, he was under Secretary of State for Economic Affairs.
Yeah, right,
I had a dinner for him at the House, and I think that was October as well. Of course, everybody came in armored cars, and they had to leave by 10 o'clock because of curfew and so forth and so on. So it was a very, and I had all the establishment there. The head of the central bank, the head of Bank Melli, and some other.
What was the atmosphere?
The atmosphere was nervous, questioning, wondering whether the economy could survive. This was mostly looking at the economy, because everything was tied up in strikes by that time. It was a difficult time for anybody.
Now, you mentioned earlier some of the concerns of the American community, vis-a-vis the embassy. How would these concerns take it through more and more as
they grew more and more real, especially in the first, I think it was the first week of November, when the riots moved up into the middle of Tehran and burned. For instance, the Waldorf Hotel, which I could see out of my window. I had Dennis Neal from the U.S. News and World Report with me that day, and I was on the 11th floor of a building downtown. We could walk around and watch the whole city burn. There was smoke coming from every direction. The rioters were swept up north of Takht-i Jamshid, set a number of places on fire. Broke a lot of windows and were trashing things. Why they missed my building, I don't know. They trashed all the windows of all the airlines except Air Flot, and I forgot who the other one was, but it was an Eastern European one. Then about 3 o'clock, the troops came down from the north, and as if by arrangement, the rioters withdrew to the south, and the northern part of the city was once again in the hands of the government. By that time in November, we were all starting to move the business community was moving dependents and other unessential people out of the country. Now, some companies bugged out very early, much to the distress of the embassy. And some of the dependents of the embassy wanted to leave and did leave. And Bill Sullivan was quoted at one point telling one officer, "Well, you will never work for me again in any embassy of mine if you send your people home." So that was the attitude that we felt, that we were being held hostage for a policy that seemed to be failing by that time.
What were some of the companies that were leaving?
Westinghouse. Sent everybody home. Didn't leave anybody. Some of the companies simply couldn't function because you couldn't get residence permits, and you had to send your people out while they still had valid exit permits. You couldn't pay your personnel. So a number of companies simply decided, well, let's get everybody out of here that we can, while we can, and maintain a skeleton crew, and we'll come back when things are back to normal.
No, I've seen the State Department cable that was declassified a while ago, from around October, maybe early November, that suggested that some Iranian businessmen and government officials for concluding that the demonstrations and strikes would not cease until the Shah left the country. Did you hear such arguments before you left Iran?
Well, yeah. By that time, it was clear that there was a good deal of pressure on the Shah to leave, and he was resisting all those pressures. But from the embassy, no, I never heard anybody from the embassy. I wonder who wrote that? George?
I think it was one of Sullivan's cables.
One of Sullivan's cables.
But he wasn't remote or not.
Yeah.
But these are Iranian contacts that were discussing this with you.
Many of my Iranian contacts had already left the country.
Okay.
Not all of them, of course, because some of the businessmen stayed on thinking, well, you know, we're businessmen, we're not politicians. Little did they realize they too would be held up. But there was no people like Reza Fala, who was the deputy head of the National Iranian Oil Company. He left early on. And even on the plane I left on, when I left Iran, which was December 21st or 22nd, 78, there were a dozen businessmen and government officials of one sort or another that were bugging out at that time. But they'd stayed late. Many of them had already left.
Now, after the demonstrations you talked about where buildings were burned and so forth in Tehran, the Shah installed a military government.
That's when Sharif Emami was removed and General Azhari took over.
Uh-huh. What was your evaluation of this move? Did you think it would make a difference at this point? Maybe make things worse?
Well, it seemed to indicate that they were prepared to use the military in a forceful manner in the event it didn't happen. That was the thing that everybody thought the Shah had pulled out of his sleeve, that we'd install a military government and we'd restore order and then we'd go back to trying to put the pieces back together. But the Shah was unwilling, apparently, and again this comes out afterwards, we certainly didn't know it at the time, was unwilling to order any drastic action. And again, with hindsight, it probably wouldn't have worked. They probably wouldn't have paid any attention to him by that time. Who knows?
By November, it's around the same time, Ambassador Sullivan was concluding, I think, that are beginning to conclude that the Shah's position was hopeless, or apparently hopeless, and it was necessary to begin to search for some alternative to the Shah. Did you know what?
Thinking the unthinkable.
That was the name of the famous cable.
Yeah.
Now, how much?
Infamous cable, I would call it.
How much did you know about his views at this time?
Damn little, because about that time, he had brought. Senator, who was it? Senator Byrd? I guess it was.
Possibly. I think he visited.
I think it was Senator Byrd.
I'm not sure.
Because he was scheduled to address the Iran American Chamber in November. And we had our monthly luncheon at the Sheraton, Aria Sheraton. And Byrd couldn't make it because he had an audience with the Shah, and we sort of held forth until Bill got there, and then he filled us in on what was going on. But his message to us then was, stay put. There wasn't any give on his part, so if he was thinking the unthinkable at that point, he didn't let on.
Mm-hmm. Now, at what point did you conclude the Shah's position could not be salvaged?
After I was back here in December.
After you'd left.
After I'd left.
Then, up till then, you still weren't.
I still kept hope. I guess it was more hoping than anything else. Hoping that he would be, because I'm always very slow in withdrawing support. I was hoping against hope that he would be able to put it back together, and so I had a round-trip ticket. But then the company wouldn't let me come back as things deteriorated, which was quite right. But when I left in the third or fourth week of December, just before Christmas, I was just going home to spend Christmas with my family. I was not evacuating. I left my house intact with all my furniture in it, my houseboy, my dogs, and a gardener. And of course, my wife, when she had left 3 weeks before, she had packed up all the so-called valuables and shipped them out, just as a personal note. In the event, they didn't leave the country at that time, and it wasn't until May of 78 that they discovered them in the warehouse at the airport. They'd gone through customs, and they were sitting there waiting for shipment on Lufthansa, and so they finally shipped them, and they didn't have to go through customs again. Otherwise, we probably would have lost everything, because there were pictures of me with the Shah, and there were some carpets and some pots and so forth and so on that the Revolutionary Guards would have confiscated. Also have all of our silver, and a lot of personal things, photographs. But I finally showed up. But as an example, I left my house intact, except for those few things that my wife had packed.
Now
that makes me look a little stupid, maybe, but it showed the depth of my respect for the Shah's ability to come back. Mm-hmm. He'd done it before. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the same month, during the religious holidays, Muharram.
Yeah.
There were huge demonstrations in Tehran, I guess involving millions of people.
Millions of people, yeah. Right.
Did you witness any of these? Or?
We were well advised and did stay off the streets. Mm-hmm. That was in early December. My family had left by then. I was alone. I had a few people from the company over for lunch, and we just stayed out of sight. And some of them even spent the night, because there was no point in trying to go back downtown. But I talked to then a day or two later, Mehdi Sami. Let's see, forgotten which demonstration that was, but there was the Muharram demonstration was, no, that was not the one. It was the one previous to that, when he qualified it as a middle class demonstration, a family demonstration. You had whole families walking down Shemron, carrying flowers and sticking flowers in the rifles of the soldiers who were guarding them. But it was a middle class demonstration. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people marching up and down Shemron Road, demonstrating for change, for democracy, for whatever. But this was not the madcap Mujahideen revolutionaries or anything of that sort. Now the Muharram demonstrations were massive, well organized, well policed by the revolutionaries themselves. And it was a demonstration that had to have had a very debilitating effect on the Shah's psyche. And I guess it did. Because to have a couple of million people out was a fantastic sight. No, I wouldn't have shown myself out there, frankly. Foolhardy.
Now you returned to the States, you worked for GE, you continued to work for GE.
Yes, I continued. I ran Tehran, because I left the staff. We didn't pull all Americans out when I left. I had about 8 or 10 people still there, Americans, plus all my Iranian staff. And so I moved to London, personally. my family went to Ohio, to my wife's mother's town, and I commuted between London and the States when I could. I never did return to Iran, but I managed the withdrawal of people from Iran at the time, and it was about May, I think, that we got the last of our people out.
And the GE closed up in Iran pretty
much. Yeah, GE closed up. Well, we still left the local staff still.
Yeah, yeah.
And they closed up the office in an orderly fashion. They packed up my house and shipped everything out. Everything that we wanted out. We didn't have any of the heavy stuff on out. But it was an orderly departure. And had, by even in May, April, if the situation had righted itself and the government had wanted us to come back and stay, we would have been in a position to do so.
Yeah. At that time, you know, in the late 78, early 79, what was your interpretation of the origins, of the basic causes of the revolution?
Well,
how did you see it then?
Well, I saw it then as a weakening of the resolve of the Shah, a growth of the opposition in terms of numbers and volubility and strength and economic strength. To the point that they could do a lot of things. Now, whether they were helped by outside forces, I didn't know. Although towards the end of 78, it was clear that the religious element was doing a lot more than they ever had before. They were able, because they were getting lots of money from the bazaaris in Tehran, over in Najaf, in Iraq, and then I believe, with the connivance of General Farduz, the Shah asked the Iraqis, they're now great and good friends because they'd settled all their differences, to expel the Ayatollah. That happened in, I think, about September. Didn't it? Then he went to Paris because the Kuwaitis wouldn't take him, and that gave him open sesame. They got access to world attention, but they kept him in the job, I bet nothing would have happened, or very little would have happened. The Mujahideen would have taken charge, perhaps, of the revolution thing, but not the religious. Because the only one with the authority, moral and public relations authority, to take charge of the revolution at that time was Khomeini. Nobody else could. Shariat Madari, any of the other Ayatollahs who were in opposition to the Shah had been pretty much compromised over the years.
No, I've read at that time that some American business leaders like David Rockefeller, I've read that he believed that ultimately the communists were behind the whole thing. Did other American businessmen believe that?
Yes, of course. Yeah, you know, and again, going back to the November showdown. And this is personal observation. The leader of one of the gangs, stoning shops and breaking windows and setting fire to things, was a lady in pantsuits. Clearly, she wasn't a religious lady. She wasn't wearing a chador, and she was a real instigator, real rioter, and probably left wing. Now let me move to another area, the television, Iranian television, and the AFRT, leave AFRT out of it. On the night before Muharram, before this big demonstration, when all the religious were out shouting Ali Akbar and so forth, and electricity was out, and so forth and so on. On television, before the electricity went off, they were showing, I guess it was Swedish,
Oh, I think you talked about that.
Yes, yeah, Sweet's movie about lesbianism, yeah, nudity, yeah, and everything.
That, yeah.
Totally designed, as far as I was concerned, to incite the religious conservative elements against the regime.
Yeah, okay.